You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lily and Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday, the 29th of May. Sorry, I was going to say March, not March. Coming up on the show today on Dear Science with AUT's Alan Blackman, we're talking about breaking records, remaking energy and new chemical substances. Sherry talks to Claire Caldwell, the curator of the International Art Exhibition, This Is Where I Live, from people who have experienced homelessness. I'm going to touch on the budget a little. We have New Zealand First talking about the Provincial Growth Fund and where the money goes, and we will have Sherry popping down to the teachers' strike in Altair Centre later in the show. I'm going to get straight into it though, because it is a massive show. Remember that you can catch everything online on the 95BFM website, and if you want to get in touch, send us a text on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yeah, thanks MOTAT.
Yeah, absolutely.
How are you, Alan?
I'm gobsmacked that somebody was singing Smash Mouth at a protest. I think that's just hilarious.
The things we do.
Anyway, what are we going to talk about today?
I'm just trying to think of what lyrics they would have been.
There's something about
ice caps melting in that song, I'm pretty sure. Anyway, okay. there is some relevance. Sure.
Okay, they weren't just, okay.
But first we're talking about scientists breaking the record for the highest temperature superconductor.
Amen. Yeah.
What does that mean?
This is really good. Okay, so we all know that metals, for example, are very good conductors of electricity and heat, things like that.
Yes.
And so we normally transport our electricity from our hydro dams and everything through wires. So these big old transmission wires at very, very high voltages.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, we lose around about 6% of the electricity that we generate just through basically heat. Okay,
that's so a bummer.
The wires have a resistance. Okay, a resistance to flow, just like a pipe has a resistance to water flowing through it, so wires have resistance to electricity running through it. Mm-hmm. So wouldn't it be great if we could make wires that don't have any resistance?
It would.
And then we wouldn't lose all of that electricity, which 6% of all the electricity sort of generated in the country is a buttload.
Yeah.
It's a buttload of electricity. So for a long time now, people have been really interested in making these things called superconductors. And these are essentially things that can conduct electricity without any resistance. So that means that you'd lose nothing. You lose no heat or anything like that, that the electricity just flows through the stuff and keeps flowing and keeps flowing, and you never lose any. And if you can make your wires out of superconductors, then you wouldn't
lose. Off you go.
Yeah. And also they're very, very useful in, or potentially useful in transport. So we've got these maglev trains that you may or may not have heard of. Shanghai, if you've been to Shanghai Airport, they've got a maglev train there. That's short for magnetic levitation.
Wow. Oh, no, yeah, we definitely don't have that.
And basically, you get a superconductor and you put a magnet on top of it, and the magnet just floats on top of the superconductor.
Cool.
Okay? And that means, again, no friction. And so, you know, this good things. Good things, superconductors. Good things. So, way back in 1985, a couple of Germans found the first what they call high-temperature superconductor, and that was at a temperature of liquid nitrogen temperature, so about minus 196 mm-hmm. degrees Celsius. And prior to that, superconductors were only known at really, really, really low temperature, like a few Kelvin, a few, you know, degrees above absolute zero.
Wow.
So, somebody got the Nobel Prize for discovering the first high-temperature superconductor, and ever since then, the holy grail has been room-temperature superconductors. So, at the moment, you've got to cool things down in liquid nitrogen to get them to superconduct. If you get it to room temperature, then you're going to be rich, you're going to win a Nobel Prize, and you're going to save the world a hell of a lot of energy.
Awesome.
So, this week in Nature, there are a bunch of workers who have reported that they have been able to make something that superconducts at minus 23 degrees Celsius. Yo, okay.
We're getting close.
And so these are people from Germany, the States, Poland, and Russia. So joint scientific endeavor here. And yeah, negative 23 degrees Celsius. Now, that is absolutely brilliant. It's 50 degrees higher than the previous highest temperature superconductor. The only slight problem with this is that in order to get it to superconduct, they had to compress it to 170 gigapascals, which is a mere million to a million and a half atmospheres.
So we're talking...
So we're talking not very viable at the moment.
Because you, that's not...
Because that's... Yeah. But it's a start.
Yeah.
So the stuff that they used was a lanthanum hydrogen compound, and... You know, this is proof of principle stuff.
Right. So they're proving the rule or making it happen.
Yeah.
But in order to get it to something viable in terms of just everyday life.
Well, there's a lot of work going to go down the track, between, obviously. Okay. But hell, if you can get something superconducting at minus 23 degrees Celsius, then, you know, room temperature is really not that far away.
No.
And this, you know, this is pretty darned exciting, I would say, which is why it's been published in Nature.
And will they get a Nobel Prize for this? Or is it about getting it viable first?
Do they
try and get it to room temperature first, or do they do the viable, like, get
No, I would imagine they would just cool it down and then just slowly warm it up and just see when it stops superconducting. But,
okay.
You know, this is very, very important stuff, this. It really is. The people who are doing this work, yeah, deserve all the plaudits.
Kudos.
And everything. So who knows where this may lead. And again,
and also, how long are we talking?
Well, that's the question that you often ask on this program, Lillian.
Well, it's just, you know, it's a reality.
I know, and my
we
answer
need solutions.
Is, yeah, my answer is always, you know, more research is needed, you know. And they had a one of the heading, you know, headlines in The Onion or whatever, you know, scientists say no more research needed, you know.
That is so good. That is so good.
But
that is becoming a sting.
You know, it is really, really exciting, really important stuff, and you know, they'll keep working, and you know, one day it'll happen.
Yeah.
You know, and that'll really change the world.
Mm.
Be brilliant.
Okay.
Yep.
Second topic, which to me is also sounds like good news, using gold to turn CO2 into liquid fuel.
Yes, indeed. Now, this is very
important. Really need.
Oh, no, this is very important research as well. Okay, so everybody knows the problem with CO2. Okay, so it's a greenhouse gas, so it stops all of the infrared being emitted back out to space, warms up the Earth, etc., etc., etc. Not a good thing. Can we get rid of it? And this is a question a lot of people have asked. And, you know, there's lots of ways that have been proposed that we could, you know, get rid of this. We could, you know, pump it into the oceans, or we could sort of bury it in mines and things like that. All sorts of weird things.
Well, that just seems like putting a problem
aside
for later.
Yes. So, ideally, what would be really good is if we could actually turn CO2 into something useful.
Yes.
Which is not easy, because CO2 is what we would call a thermodynamic sink. It's where carbon wants to be. You give any atom of carbon on planet Earth the choice, and it will desperately want to be CO2.
Okay.
And it'll do everything it can to get there. So that means getting out, turning CO2 into something else, is going to be a high-energy process. So these folk at the University of Illinois have reported the fact that they can now use gold nanoparticles to turn CO2 into liquid fuels, as you say, or gaseous fuels, so methane, ethane, propane, these very, very short-chain hydrocarbons, which when you burn them can generate energy, turn into CO2, and then you take the CO2 back to this, etc., etc., etc.
Right.
Okay, so you're kind of getting money for nothing here.
Yeah.
And the beauty of this process is you don't have to put any energy into it. It's driven by visible light.
Wow.
Okay, so they're basically using these gold nanoparticles. And nanoparticles have dimensions of nanometers, so 10 to the minus 9 meters. So they're sort of clusters of, you know, maybe a couple of hundred gold atoms, something like that. Really, 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 really small.
Okay.
And they have weird features. When you make solids small, they start doing very, very strange things when they get down onto this nanoscale. and gold is no exception. Here it forms these nanoparticles, which can exhibit all different colors and everything. They're, you know, they're really cool depending on their size.
Mm.
And so these guys have found that basically you can pump in CO2 and H2O, which are the ingredients for photosynthesis.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of making sugars like photosynthesis does, this is going to make liquid fuels, which, you know, that's kind of nice.
That's amazing.
That's kind of nice. And again, as I say, when you burn the liquid fuels, it just turns it back into CO2 again, and then you can regenerate liquid fuels just by taking the waste CO2 and
wow,
pumping it around and around and around. So
renewable energy, you know, this is recyclable energy.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Gold,
yep.
We're talking, won't people then be, you know, increasing the attempts to, like, mine for gold to use this for this process? Won't that be another problem? Or are we talking very, very small amounts of gold?
Well, we're talking nanoparticles, yeah. Certainly. We're probably talking a decent whack of gold, but it's not going to be used up or anything like that.
Right.
So it's a pure catalyst in this case.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So, yeah, again, more work is needed. But, you know, these guys can be pretty pleased with themselves. I think this is really, really nice stuff.
But a no step in the right direction, right? We just keep going.
Well, that's what it all is. It's all baby steps.
Yeah.
It is, so, yeah.
Okay, our last story.
Now, don't give away the number here.
Okay, well, what I've written is that the Chemical Abstract Service has registered another unique substance.
There we go, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so, what was his name? Linnaeus. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of Linnaeus?
No.
Okay, so he was a Swedish guy, and he sort of did the whole kingdom, phylum, genus, species, all that sort of stuff. So he catalogued nature, basically.
Wow, okay.
And he sort of gave it some order. And we need that in chemistry as well, because chemistry is just, you know, a whole lot, a truckload of different compounds.
Right.
How do we order those? How do we keep a track of them? How do we know how many compounds there are on the planet? And so a company called the Chemical Abstract Service was set up in around about the 60s, I think the early 60s, basically to do just that, to keep track of every chemical compound on planet Earth. Every last one. Okay, so these are natural compounds and these are synthetic compounds. You know, basically anything.
Big job.
And what they do is that they give each distinct chemical compound a number. And so, for example, water is 7732-18-5.
Oh, whoa.
Salt is 7647-14-5. And I don't know why I looked this up, but heroin is 561-27-3.
Okay. So literally has a number.
Everything has a number. And this very week, or last week, they have just registered their 150 millionth chemical compound.
Wow.
Which, when...
It's huge.
Well, when you consider that it took them 44 years to get their 50 millionth compound,
yeah.
And that was in 2009. That was 10 years ago.
Okay.
So in the intervening 10 years, we have made 100 million
more
new compounds.
We've made more, yes. Or we've just given them a number?
No, we have made.
Whoa.
Okay. So we are talking, get this, 25,000 new chemical compounds a week.
Far out.
I think that's utterly extraordinary. People ask us what chemists do. That's what chemists do.
That is incredible.
Absolutely remarkable. So that's a big milestone there. 150 million compounds in the Chemical Abstract Service.
What's an example of somebody making a compound?
Me.
You just go and
do an experiment. And you make new things.
Something.
And you think, shit, this has never existed on Earth before. That is so cool. It is such an amazing feeling.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Have you done it?
Yes.
Oh, hell awesome. Yeah. And then do you bring up the Chemical Abstract Service? Like, hey.
No. The way that it's normally done is that you publish it.
Okay.
And then they go through every single paper that has been published, and they pull out all of the unique compounds in that and give them numbers and stuff.
Boy, that's a
tough job. So they're funded by the American Chemical Society.
Okay.
So they're part of that. And in order to get, and this is the world's biggest index, basically,
yeah, right.
By far and away. And in order to get access to this index, you do have to pay, obviously. And so you get institutional subscriptions, you know, the universities and stuff like that. It's not cheap.
No.
As you can well imagine, because it's a big bloody job.
I thank you for that Alan, we are going to wrap it up here, but I just somebody texted in about the highest temperature superconductor story. They said minus 23 degrees, question mark. That is room temperature in some student flats. I would agree.
Would that
thank
be
you,
an extended night, possibly,
yeah,
I'd say.
Possibly. All right. Well, thank you very much, Alan. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Okay, we'll do. See ya.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
This week at the Hollywood Avondale.
It's an incredible week of classic cinema. Thursday at 8 p.m. is Walter Hill's 1979 banger, The Warriors, on 35mm. Friday, it's Harry Dean Stanton's standout performance alongside Emilio Estevez in Repo Man, 8 p.m. Then Sunday at 5 p.m, a 35th anniversary screening of Prince's Purple Rain.
The Hollywood Avondale, your local independent church of cinema. Tickets and details at hollywoodavondale.nz or their Facebook page.
Good morning. Okay, the new Cater Station jingle. What have you got, creative? Give me gold.
The Cater Station.
Yep.
Yum.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Anything else?
Yeah. When your team needs filling up, they can't be satisfied. Their appetites need servicing, so open wide.
Could we outsource this one?
Great idea.
Cater Station are holding a competition to find their new jingle. Do you have what it takes? If you do, you could be walking away with a cool $1,000 cash. Find out more. Go to 95bfm.com or text jingle to 5395.
Listen. Listen to Sigrid's radio show. It's just music, but for 3 hours. Sigrid. Selections by Sigrid. Very good songs. Sigrid. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen to it. The Thursday 1 to 4 with Sigrid on 95BFM. Listen live or tune in later on podcast and RSS. It's Thursday afternoon, 1 to 4. Listen, it's just music.
It's
just music.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
This Is Where I Live is an art exhibition opening tonight at Merge Cafe on K Road. The project is an international exchange of art created by people who have experienced homelessness. Sherry talks with the curator Claire Curran on the exchange of art from different cities, the importance of showing the perspective of our homeless community, the paradigm shifts she hopes in our dialogues around supporting them, and the role of visual art. Sherry begins by asking Claire how she is feeling with the opening of the exhibition.
Oh, pretty busy. I've got lots of projects on the go, so, yeah, this is just one of them.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about what the exhibition is.
It's called, it's an international art exchange, really, across the world, called This Is Where I Live, and it was initiated in London in 2012, by a social enterprise called Cafe Art. And at that stage, they just had London and New York. And the cities involved, the art's all connecting to people who are homeless or who have experienced homelessness or just marginalized people generally. So the idea was to just make some kind of global connection between all these people, create like a whole culture within that, and give them an international voice and obviously a lovely lens in which to redefine themselves as artists, not just homeless and marginalized people that are sitting on the side of the road being ignored. And then how I got involved really, it was my daughter, Sarah Caldwell Watson, started working for them a few years ago, and she took over this project. And last year, we were involved, Auckland City Mission was involved, and work from my guys was sent over to London, and it was then, some of it was exhibited in London, but the other cities involved are New York, Berlin, Mumbai, and last year Melbourne.
Wow, so it's a really international project.
Yeah. It's amazing. And I just watched the painters in my class just walking around with their chests out saying, you know, my work's being exhibited in Berlin or New York or London. I mean, how cool is that?
It's an amazing opportunity.
It is. Yeah. And they sold instantly last year. Sales are a little bit slower this year, but it's just the exposure of getting their concepts because my class is predominantly Māori, and their version of expressing this is where I live has been wonderful. It's been very conceptual and very unlike the other countries that are a little more literal. They go back to their roots, back to Papatua Nuku and Ranganui, and so it's very it stands out as a body of work. And this year, even Melbourne's fallen away, unfortunately, but Dar es Salaam is the newest city to come on board, and we've got some really exciting work from a young 18-year-old.
Which city is that?
Dar es Salaam. That's in Tanzania.
Okay, wow.
Yeah, so that's been a real, very rich addition, and we're hoping to get Sydney on board next year.
How many years has this project been running now?
Well, it started in 2012, so yeah, about seven years. And the idea is to just keep expanding it, because Cafe Art runs another project called a calendar project, and that's pushing out into different cities. So they might start all doing the same, like Toronto is part of the calendar project. They might be willing to come on board with this one.
You mentioned that you hold classes. So what's it been like, the process behind the art, so supporting the artists through, you know, helping them create their vision?
Well, I just leave them to it, actually. When I say I'm the art tutor, I do more kind of enabling and guiding than actual teaching. If I see something, I'll encourage, obviously. And with the more, the painters that have been working now for about 3 years painting seriously, I will come in and say that doesn't quite work, you know. But apart from that, I've just left them to interpret their own vision of the theme of the show, and just come up with that, really.
Are there any interesting connections you found through, because it's so international, but are there some surprising similarities or differences between the different pieces of art?
Actually, they're all quite different, which is what makes it so lovely. No, I don't think there are a lot of similarities between the different cities, and that's why it's such a rich show, because I can't speak for what has influenced those artists there. Some of them have written their stories, so I've put those up on the wall beside their paintings, and some of them are just beautiful. They're actually quite poignant as to what the art has given them. And it's the same with my guys. Doing art, they all appreciate how therapeutic it is. It's not just about the fine arts, it's about the creative process being very healing and transformative in itself.
It sounds like a big community project, yeah. And how has it been working with Merge Cafe? Because they do quite a few different things within the community.
Oh, great, yeah.
Yeah.
They're very, very accommodating.
Yeah.
I have worked with them before, and I know some of them, so I'm, not a total stranger. Of course, I know a lot of the people that go there, but oh, look, you have your usual dramas and things going wrong.
Oh, no.
It wouldn't be a show unless a few things went wrong.
Yeah.
But, they're all fixable and it'll be okay on the day.
That's good. Yeah. How long have you been working in the space now, like putting up the exhibition?
Oh, we started yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, so opening tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah.
What dialogues do you think we need to have around homelessness? And what do you think needs to change in the way we perceive the community?
Well, I guess, as I said before, I think it's very important that they're not just seen as discarded human beings. I mean, when they come to my class, I don't know what they've done, who they've been, what their stories are until they choose to tell me. And out of these groups have come some of the most brilliant talent. So I think people have got to realise that talent and intelligence falls indiscriminately in society. So don't write these people off as being just, alcoholics and drug users. But all their stories are different. Come to that position, maybe they're not all there now, but through a whole lot of reasons. And to be honest, a lot of people are saying now we're only all a couple of pay packets away from being homeless. It can happen to anybody, and I think we need to have a little more humility around that.
Do you have any thoughts on the level of support as currently given to the community? Do you think it's adequate or more needs to be done?
Well, I'd like to see a really big paradigm shift from the top. Politically, I think, you know, we're just reinforcing the same old paradigm and saying, oh, there's not enough money, and yet there's masses of big businesses not paying taxes. And if those taxes could be paid, there'd be a lot more support and help for people that are vulnerable. Because currently, no, I don't think they're getting enough support. And there's a lot of judgment and a lot of punitive kind of behaviour around it. It's pretty demoralising. And when you feel demoralised, you can lose your self-esteem and you can just spiral downwards. So what those of us working in these communities are trying to do with art is to rebuild that self-esteem very gently, you know, from the inside out. And I've had a few people that have now moved out of the class and they're working full time.
It's amazing to hear.
I can only assume that, you know, hopefully I was part of that process, starting planting the seeds, you know.
Mm. Yeah, that touches on my final question on how do you feel the role of art plays in mental health and supporting vulnerable people?
Oh, I think it's huge. Mm. Yeah. And I've had a bit of involvement with Toyora, who they deal with people that have mental health issues or have had mental health issues. And there's a lot of crossover. I mean, a lot of the people that come to the City Mission do suffer from mental health issues, some more overtly than others. And I think art gives them a very safe arena to express things about themselves, because words are very emotive and sometimes talking therapies don't work that well. Mm. And art sort of, it predates language anyway. We started making art probably before we had language, when we were very early humans. So we've always had that as a very powerful expression of who we are in the world and what we're feeling about what's going on. So I just think that continues, and that's what I encourage.
Was there anything else you wanted to add? Because just the themes you talked about, I'm like, yeah. Yeah, that's important shit.
Oh, yeah. Good. Well, yeah, it's very important shit, actually. Yeah. I'm quite passionate about it. It's a bit of a soapbox for me to bring art as a therapy into the arena. There's a lot more applications. It could be it is in the prisons. They do a lot of art there. But even with little children that are scared and fearful waiting for an operation or... You know, there's so many applications of doing art that can be therapeutic. And I think in terms of fine arts, New Zealand needs to really give a lot more support to the art. It's a bit pathetic, really. It's seen as very other. And I mean, to actually have schools take art out of the curriculum, to me, is just horrifying. You know, you need to think creatively, even if you're doing engineering or maths, it's still creative thinking. So I think people need to understand the role and power and absolute essence of what creativity is and how important it is. Evolution. Yeah.
Yeah, because I was reading a spin-off article just before talking about the state of creative art in Aotearoa and the kind of, it's hard to make a living out of it sometimes, and the lack of support and lack of funding. What's your thoughts
times,
on that?
Actually, not many people make a living out of it. Mm. Most people are working or being supported or whatever. Yeah, I don't know many people that are making a living out of it, a livable living out of it. Yeah.
So something needs to change in our perception. A lot of our perceptions.
I think so.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the role of community art specifically? Because I think sometimes people think, oh, fine arts, it sits in a gallery and it's all airy-fairy. But
you mean like murals and things like that?
They're projects that really involve the community.
I think they're great. They definitely have their place. And it's a nice way of coming together to do something creative together. It's a little romanticised to me. There's often a bit of dissension when people are all working on one thing together.
Yeah.
And I've experienced this myself. But I think in essence they're a really great idea. And the good thing about it is it gets art out into the community where it's visible. Mm. It becomes part of the local area, like the local township, or, you know, it's everywhere. Like, it's lovely to see it on power boxes and walls, and, you know, I'd love it if we had a lot more street art on buildings here, like everywhere.
Was there a mural that was going to be set up around Merge Cafe? Yeah.
There's one out the back that they're working on feverishly, so that the idea is to unveil that.
Okay.
Tomorrow night,
exciting.
As well.
Yeah.
And it's looking lovely.
That's
it's
good.
Going to be very exciting. So hopefully the weather will ease off a bit so they can keep working on it today.
That exhibition opens tonight at Lifewise Merge Cafe on K Road.
The Wire.
Yes, indeed. You are listening to The Wire. And before we go into our New Zealand First piece, I just want to touch on the budget, which is being announced tomorrow. So the wellbeing budget is being seen as a new approach to tackle long-term issues. Traditionally, budgets are like an auction. Ministers and departments bid for their slice of the pie, that pie being new money, which is roughly around $1 billion. So new spending, what does that mean? Most of the budgets are pretty set, particularly for in particular health, education and welfare. So any new money gets divided up. Documents go to the finance minister, then there will be one-on-ones where someone argues the case for their bid about where that money should go, and it'd be like a bidding war. So it'd actually help if you're good at lobbying or able to put up a good argument. But now, with the change in the focus on a wellbeing budget, the government departments have to work together in their budget bids, which also means far more communication between departments as part of achieving the end goal. So working on child poverty, for example, would mean all the relevant departments work together to ensure each aspect of that approach gets the money it needs. The government has already made pre-budget announcements tackling Māori offending and the family sexual violence package with this multi-pronged approach. For the latter, Oranga Tamariki, Te Puni Kōkiri, the Ministry of Social Development, the Ministry of Justice and Police are among the 10 government agencies involved in the police strategy. In terms of mental health, the government has only just made an announcement regarding their response to the inquiry into mental health and addiction. They have accepted in principle or agreed to further consideration of 38 of the 40 recommendations of the inquiry panel. So this includes significantly increasing access to publicly funded mental health and addiction services for people with mild to moderate needs, commitment to increased choice by broadening the types of services available, urgently complete the National Suicide Prevention Strategy, establish an independent commission to provide leadership and oversight of mental health and addiction, and repeal and replace the Mental Health Compulsory Assessment and Treatment Act of 1992. So, back to this budget. Every new bid for government money also needs to stand the test of time, so there's a heavy focus on intergenerational benefit. That means Treasury has to consider the cost of the project over the next 30 to 40 years. The final difference is how success is measured, so rather than looking at GDP, there are a number of wellness indicators that have been settled on to measure the country's well-being. You can find these on the Stats New Zealand Indicators website. These are broken into four areas, so current and then future well-being, contextual factors and impact on the world. Current well-being would look like things like air quality, cities and settlements, so access to natural spaces, or homelessness or housing affordability, economic standards of living, health, governance, identity, safety, social connections, subjective well-being, that sort of thing. Future well-being is where you have things like financial and physical capital, human capital, natural capital, social capital, and then the impact on the rest of the world is things like climate or consumption of net greenhouse gas emissions, economic standard of living, financial and physical capital, again, human capital, natural capital, again, and waste. And then finally, the contextual indicators would include population and production. So population, age and sex structure, disability status, ethnic composition, family composition, fertility, so on. Production, components of final use, national income, production by industry, regional production, returns for factors of production and total New Zealand production. So those GDP factors are still part of that, but it's becoming a sort of wider look at people's health, essentially, and well-being. One final note I'll make about the budget is the leak that has occurred. This has meant that National have released some information about the Labour Coalition government's budget ahead of time. Not only does this mess up the democratic process in which a government's budget should be treated, but it does give National a very small window prior to Labour's announcement to get their framing around the conversation. But stay tuned for all the full announcements tomorrow. And also just a note that the hack against the Treasury is now being treated as a police issue, so I'm sure more information will come out about that.
It's time for Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
we do have Fletcher Tapatoa with us again this week, and we touch briefly on the budget, but mostly talk about where the money from the Provincial Growth Fund actually goes. I started by asking Fletcher how this budget works compared to previous ones.
Yes, so the way that it's different is how ministers ask the question on what they want to spend the money on. So there are three big kind of questions. And is it intergenerational? Will it make a difference now? But also, what is the effect of this spending going to be for our children, our grandchildren, etc.? And then, how does this move this beyond kind of the old-fashioned measures of success? Like, yep, GDP is great, and actually really important, but how else do we measure success when you come and ask for money from the finance minister? And is it a whole of government approach? How well are we working together to understand, how to kind of identify the bigger issues, but also how do we best spend money, not just for today, but what does that look like tomorrow? Mm-hmm. So I think that those are the conversations that ministers have had to have, both internally and then with one another.
And so last week, this came out the day we would normally talk on a Wednesday, but I did want to bring it up, and it's a News Talk ZB article on how the Provincial Growth Fund is actually being spent. And the first line of it is saying that most Provincial Growth Fund announcements are for plans rather than actual projects, and most of the money is going straight back to various branches of government. So what does that actually mean?
It means that if you're out in the regions and you are a small business or even a big business, if you look at Gisborne and Hawke's Bay, you know, there's a lot of growers and things like that. Some of the fundamental issues they have are around transport and what needs to be done to kind of boost the region's economy, which is exactly what we're trying to do, is look at basic infrastructure like roads and rail, and how do we make it more efficient and more accessible so that, actually goods might get to the market cheaper, so we're paying less for our apples, or there's more margin so that these guys are making more money, employing more people, spending more in their communities, which is, you know, this wonderful money go round, which is so important for regional economic growth, for anyone's economic growth. Mm. So when they talk about other government departments, essentially the Provincial Growth Fund has built roads, it has committed to fixing up rail, so that's what they mean by that. The other part of that is right at the start of a big $3 billion project. No one's just going to give money away, and so the attacks on Minister Jones in the past have been, he's flitting it away and, you know, just dumping big wads of cash in the regions. Well, that's completely untrue. A lot of, as the article says, a lot of the work that was being done initially, which was coming from the regions, remember, they were asking for these things, was about proving the case. If the government's going to give you $10 million for a road or for a critical piece of infrastructure, is it actually going to make the difference that you claim it will? And we've got to get experts in to answer that, otherwise we're not spending money in good faith.
Right, so does that happen before or after the announcement?
A lot of those, well, it's both actually. So I'm the Undersecretary, so I kind of do the smaller packages, and a lot of what I have been announcing have been those kind of, here's some money to do a business plan or a case study or some analysis in the market so that people can make a decision, those people in the community, is it as good as we think it is? And then I'll announce that and give them the money. That kind of thing.
Right. So when you do make the announcement, there is a transfer of money?
Not on announcement day. It's quite a rigorous process. So we've got to make sure that, we don't like the idea of giving lots of money to big big corporates to do research for the region, so we want to make sure that the people doing the research are ideally in the regions themselves, for example, and they've got to have a plan on how they approach it. And, you know, so as long as we're comfortable, then they get given the money.
Right.
And sometimes it might be in chunks. You know, you don't just give them the $300,000 straight up for them to do the case study. They've got to meet milestones, prove that they're doing the work kind of thing themselves. Yeah, there's all those kind of checks and balances.
So the article goes on to say more than three quarters of the money spent has gone to government agencies, departments and councils to fast track projects or make up for funding shortfalls. Is that true?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about the three quarters, but it would be fair to say that a lot of the initial spend, most of that actually would have been council applications. So, for example, our very first announcement was Gisborne, and a lot of the application there was the council itself, and again, that was for roads, infrastructure and that kind of thing. So it's kind of, it's a reasonably fair statement, but it's always about perspective, right? I mean, that money's gone out into the community, into the region. It hasn't literally been handed over to another government department.
Right, so it isn't about just also giving it to one business or one organisation.
No, that's right. So the wonderful thing about how, well, I think it's wonderful, is so I'm the person in charge of economic development agencies in the regions, and so a lot of the good regions who got money, including Northland, got it because their economic development agency was up and running and efficient and really clever in how they got Māori, council, businesses all on the same page so that they could create essentially what you'd call it a package to come to the government and say, we want this road, we want this tourism operation, could you please help us with a little bit of funding for the museum? And every time we would say, yeah, that sounds wonderful, let us do the work with you, let's do a case study, a business study, so that we know it's going to work like you think it will. And actually, we're not going to give you all the money. What's the business going to bring? What's the council going to bring? So,
right. Yeah. And as part of that process, like if a lot of what the Provincial Growth Fund is giving out is for studies or research or planning, what's the sort of follow-up process? How do you kind of ensure that that is going to go somewhere? Or what is the requirement that you're giving these people when you do hand over that kind of commitment of research?
Yeah, good question. So in a lot of these cases, the council or the region or the economic development agency would have come to us and said, we'd like to expand our port, for example. And we would say, yep, wonderful. How do you know what it's going to do? I know. We'll give you $800,000 to do a really comprehensive study so that you know that if you're going to spend money and we're going to spend money with you, because it doesn't necessarily mean we're giving them money. So a lot of this, they have to give it back eventually. Then we get the study done, and if the case study proves that what they want is going to work, then, depending on the application, then that means we would help them with the next phase of the project, and, we'll help you expand the port, for example.
Mm.
Yeah,
and
so if, always coming back.
If the study doesn't sort of prove to be successful, is that then a waste of money?
No, because then you're not spending millions of dollars on a project that was never going to make money for the New Zealand taxpayers in the region.
Right. And what's the kind of time frame that all of these, I suppose it's different for every project.
Well, we have actually put a kind of a moratorium on business studies and case studies now. We're now saying, right, every region apart from one, I'm making a big announcement on the 10th. All the surge regions have got money except for the Hawke's Bay, and that's what I'm going to do on the 10th. Right now it's about direct investment. We probably won't be giving money away in terms of grants. We're going to help businesses directly. We're going to, those businesses that we spent the money on in the first place to help with infrastructure and things like that. So that is kind of going to be our focus going forward for the next probably year.
Okay, can I just lastly, before we go, touch on you tweeted, was it yesterday or the day before, about the major meth bust in Wellington and also the recent example in Kawerau showing what can be done with real police resourcing. And you said it's so exciting to see New Zealand fight back against organised crime. I just wondered what actually happens after a bust.
Well, the great thing from the Wellington story, I'm not sure if you read it, was that they we created that law where you could take assets from the proceeds of crime. So, excuse me, a lot of these people will now go to court and, you know, hopefully the police case is such that they'll be prosecuted and chucked in prison. And the wonderful thing I was reading was that they've already taken their boats, their cars, their houses, you know, all... ill-gotten gains. I love reading stories because I hate what drugs do to our community. You know, we need to help the individuals when they become addicted and sick, and we need a you know, a good health focus on drugs on that side of it. But on this side, when you've got these big, I'm going to call them organisations, you know, setting up business to bring drugs into the country and distribute it. I just love seeing articles like that, especially Kawerau, you know, it's quite close to home, and I know what a beautiful community is, and I know how hard it's been for the locals, because they know it was there. And so when they went in and did this clean-out, I know how much the local community just genuinely appreciated it.
But what can the fallout be from that in terms of, obviously, there could be a lot of people who are relying on that work for an income. You know, what in terms of filling that gap, now what?
Well, that's what something like the Regional Economic Development Fund is for, to create jobs. So we're getting close to 1,000 jobs created in the regions from the PGF, and we projecting to grow thousands more by the end of the period and beyond. So, and actually now's a wonderful time to people for people to get into work. We've got the Te Ara Mahi program. So if you don't have the skills you need, we're working with businesses directly now to help train you. We've got the lowest unemployment figures pretty much in the history, modern history of New Zealand. So actually, it's a great time for the motivated people who want to get out there and get a job.
That was great. Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
Ah, oof. What? Where am I?
Would you care for a cocktail?
Who are you? I was just in my kitchen and then Wambo.
There's no need for concern. Fancy a margarita.
Oh, please. Where am I?
Ha ha ha! In the in-between. The gloaming hours betwixt afternoon and night. The place we call Cocktail Corner. I can make you something with Phantomen's botanically brewed beverages.
Yes, please. Oh, wow, sorry. I thought I was in one of those weird dreams where all your teeth fall out. Oh, phew.
Cocktail Corner, a deep journey into the fantastical world of the mixed drink. 5:30 every Thursday, only on 95 BFM Drive. Proudly brought to you by Phantomen's botanically brewed beverages.
Well, my name is Chris, and I'm here to say, looking for a flatmate in the linen that's grey. You gotta be cool, and you gotta be tough. You gotta be a vegan, and no pets or smokers.
Room in Freeman's Bay Cottage. Me, urban sophisticated wine expert, French cinema aficionado. You, educated, tidy, silent.
Room in flat, Mount Eden. Text Dave.
Whoever or wherever you're after, the 95BFM Accommodation Guide is here for you. Email your listing to accommodationguide@95bfm.com. The 95BFM Accommodation Guide, every Thursday on drive and online at 95bfm.com.
Icons, visionaries, thought leaders. Half Queen and Zeki bring you H2Ho Radio. The sounds of the underground, from floaty hip-hop to wild international club heat. Just two queers making it through the night and bringing you their freshest finds and most beautiful mixes. Do we turn a misty morning breeze? H2O Radio. Saturday nights, 11 to 1 a.m., only on 95 BFM. Stay hydrated, stay wet.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back.
The Wire. You are listening to The Wire, and I have producer of The Wednesday Wire on the phone with me. Sherry, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And Sherry is down in Altair Centre, which you'll be able to hear in the background. She's gone down to the teachers' strike to find out what's happening. Can you just tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah, so 50,000 secondary and primary school teachers are striking today, and just in our Altair Square we've got 15,000, and it's affecting 773,000 students. And according to the Ministry of Education, 51% of schools have notified that they were closed. However, the figures may be higher. The teacher strike is the largest industrial action in New Zealand so far and involves two unions, the NZEI and the Post Primary Teachers Association. However, the government is insisting it will not increase the value of its offers, which is more than $1.2 billion over the 4 years. Teachers are not just protesting for increased salaries, but for more support, respect and sustainability in the profession, as classroom sizes, difficult student behaviour and needs, higher workload increases. While more teachers are entering and staying in 2018 data from the Ministry of Education, Post-Primary Teachers Association President Jack Boyle says the figure should be taken with caution, as primary and secondary school teachers face an ageing teacher population and a growing student population. There were 149 street corner protests across the city from 7 a.m. to 8:30 this morning. And just before, at around 11:30, I nipped down to Fort Street, where everyone gathered, and we walked up Queen Street to now be in Aotearoa Square. And there were songs, there was a karakia that was just before. And we've got speeches from NZEI and Post-Primary Teachers Association.
Okay, so there's a lot. Sounds like there's a lot going on, and I. This is not a new issue, right? This has been a long time coming, and it's a lot of. There's a lot of emotion involved in this, right? There are teachers that are affected, and there are children being affected as well. But we're also at a sort of standstill where the government's saying no, we can't give any more, and now we've got the largest sort of industrial action that we've seen. So how are people feeling? Why are people there?
Yeah, there's a lot of emotions. I was talking to a lady just before. She approached me and said, can you please get the message out there? She says that she is struggling because she's got classrooms of 30, 40 odd kids, and she can't give the time and energy to the kids who need a bit more attention. And she, as we were talking, like, she started getting tears in her eyes, and I got a bit emotional too, because I think everyone can say that there's a teacher in their life who's affected them, who supported them, so they really make an impact. And, you know, she really was feeling for the kids who fall through the system, who fall through the gap. And that's a general consensus for a lot of the people I've talked to today. A lot of kids who need more attention, who need more time. I was talking to Dave just before. He's a relief teacher. And he was saying that he actually retired as a teacher 9 years ago. But because of the lack of teachers, he had to go back and do relief and aid work. And he says that every term he puts in $30 to $40 of his own money to buy kids stationery, and that kids often come to his class without food, you know, without eating, and it's real tough. Like, it's a real tough profession.
I think we can all, like you said, right, we've all been we've all had a sort of relationship with a teacher who's made probably a big difference in our life, and that could make, you know, it can go either way. And when those teachers are pushed up against the wall, you know, who knows what could happen. What I think we have seen with these strikes, and because this is obviously not the first strike that has occurred within this negotiation round,
there's been
a lot of public support, right? There are people coming out and saying, not only parents but general public, just saying how important our teachers are. So what is the strike trying to achieve in terms of, I know that they've got their specific demands, but in terms of the standstill with the government, you know, where to next?
Yeah, I think some of the people I've talked to, They're saying that they want Chris Hipkins to just obviously listen to their demands, but that they don't want to be ignored anymore. They, you know, it's not just about increased salary, but it's about more respect. It's about making it a more attractive profession, so more teachers come in, more teachers get trained, and that more teachers stay in the profession. I talked to a guy with a really big banner, and I walked up to him, and I was like, oh, what would you say to Chris Hipkins? And kind of on the fly, he was like, I don't think I'll say anything to Chris Hipkins publicly. So, yeah. I think people are feeling a lot, and yeah, they're frustrated, but it's the fact that they want to be taken seriously. They want a shift in the way that the government, you know, takes the issue seriously. Yeah, it's a general consensus.
Yeah, that's quite a valid point, right, in the sense that, yeah, this has become about an issue in terms of a value issue, right? Do we value this profession?
Yeah, and you know, there's obviously the gender aspect as well. A lot of teachers are female, so it ties into that fact that this is a, you know, typically more females are in this role, and, you know, there's lower pay, there's lower respect, and so it's a lot of issues.
Is there anything else you wanted to add there, Sherry? Any good signs you saw?
I think one of my favourite signs is 2 + 2 = 5, and it's saying that, you know, you wouldn't better do that if it weren't for teachers. Little few snarky ones. I think what my favourite one is probably this one that's right to the point. It's you as tired, you as broke, you as a teacher. Punch the message through.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sherry, for going down there. We'll catch you soon.
Catch you soon.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed Your Wire for the 29th of May. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us for the show today, Alan Jones, Fletcher Tabateau and Claire Curran. Thank you to Sherry for producing and also that live cross there. Nei rā hoki te mihi, kia koutou e whakarongoana. Thank you to all of you who tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. We'll be back next week. Up next is Bridge with the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95 BFM.